It's just a profound honor for me to be here with you today, but I'm going to apologize right up front, because as I listened this morning, my story's in a really different place from where your first women bishops are going to be and what their story is going to be. So it might feel like we're a little out of sync, and I'm not doing that intentionally. I'm just going to speak from my experience. And if it feels like that for you, I'm sorry. But at the same time, let it be a point of wondering for you about what it might look like somewhere down the road. I was the 15th woman in the Episcopal Church to be made a bishop. There were women already retired from active ministry as bishops when I became a bishop. My election, I was elected, and we elect in our diocese. I was nearly on the first ballot. My gender was really not a big issue. So that's where I'm coming from. And the space from which I hope to connect with you and perhaps to provide some hope and maybe some different ways of thinking about this. As well, I am a practitioner of this thing called episcopate. You heard beautiful academic work this morning, and I'm not that. So if I can relieve you of that expectation, that would be great. I was ordained a deacon in 1994, a priest in 1995, and a bishop in 2007. And I would like to introduce you to my family, my husband Michael and our two children, Katie and our son, our Dorian is our son. Katie is 18 and Dorian 17. Katie by birth, Dorian by adoption. So we're big into the whole teen experience. And question I get asked every time, which is the one running around in your head, how are you possibly a bishop and a mother and a wife all at the same time? And I don't think it's any different than any other professional woman's career. So I think we need to just sort of let go that there's some special onus on us as women clergy. I have a great husband. We share things around the house. My kids have been doing their own laundry since about the age of 14. They can all prepare a meal for the family. And that kind of upbringing has served them quite well as my daughter's gone off to college and is far more independent than some of her first-year university colleagues. So some of those things are not a bad thing at all. And Katie, I can remember once when she was about 16, came home and said, "Why aren't you like other mothers?" And I said, "Well, you should tell me about these other mothers." You know, they're the ones that bake stuff for the school events and the PTA, but I serve on the board of the school because it's an Episcopal school. I said, it's really, you got to leave room for other people to do their thing. And about, shouldn't do it all. Be the bishop, be on the board and bake cookies for the PTA. I think something's got to give there for their sake, not so much for mine. And about 6 months later, the parents were embroiled in something and she came home and said, "I'm really glad you're not like other mothers." I said, I'm glad we have that settled. I want to just tell you a little bit about the Diocese of El Camino Real, where I come from. We are geographically and culturally a very diverse place, about 2.5 million people in our total demographic. The diocese itself is 265 miles long, and we're on a stretch between San Francisco and Los Angeles, but there's still a few hundred more miles between those two major cities that people will know, but that's the easiest reference point. Agriculture and technology and education are our major industries. We produce huge amounts of food for our country. They refer to us as the Salad Bowl of America. And our diocese includes about half of Silicon Valley. So I say to people, when you're sitting eating your salad, checking your email on your iPhone, think of us. Our church membership is only about 13,000. We count differently than you do, so we count actual membership in a congregation rather than in a geographical setting. Our average Sunday attendance is just about 5,000, and that will range from, I have one congregation that has like 12 people, another has 500. So it just depends. We have rural areas and dense urban areas. We're 48 congregations worshiping in four languages. Based on our cultural diversity, we could probably be worshiping in at least 50. Our outreach is typical. We have average Episcopalians, which in the United States perhaps is like here. Middle to upper class tend to be well-educated and white. Lots of outreach ministry to spiritually and physically poor, to homeless, students, prisoners, farm workers, gangs. We have a huge gang problem in California, which is related to drug trade, and immigration. It's a very complicated issue, but it's something in which the churches are partnering to be involved in, and it's something near and dear to my heart. But ministry opportunities for us are really about sharing the good news of Christ with people where they are. I think in our diocese, we're trying to get in touch with that reality that we're probably talking to ourselves, and we would like to get in touch with a different reality. So we want to be present to a context, whichever one we live in, which is, again, very diverse and very local. We'd like to close that gap between the culture of church and secular life, whatever that word secular means. That has a lot of meanings as well. Share our resources of intellect, time, and money. We have an incredible, as we age as a church, as you all are aging, I have retired folks who have brilliant educations. They have time to share, and getting that out into the community is something we would really like to do. We'd like to expand our repertoire of being church. You know, most of us are fixed pretty much in the 10 a.m. time slot on Sunday morning, and moving out of that is something we are exploring. We want to create safe space for spiritual exploration in Christian community and create a multi-generational and multicultural church. So trying to bridge some of the segregation that we experience in our culture. Today, I want to talk to you. I was given kind of free rein, which I thought, that's a very dangerous thing. but I think I've got it right after prayer and pondering and thinking about it quite a lot. To just talk about power and how we share it. Because when you're a bishop, you are over the whole thing. I mean, your vision, you're the only one in the diocese, or the Anglican Communion for that matter, that can see how all the pieces fit together. But I want to define power today as the ability to act, and everybody has the ability to act. It is inappropriate for us as human beings, as Christians, to think that we have no power. So if you think that, stop it. In our diocese, El Camino Real has existed for 30 years. The state of California has existed since 1859, started out as one diocese and turned into six. We're at the very tail end of that. When they developed the diocese, they envisioned this very empowered laity, as I mentioned earlier, and they envisioned a bishop that would sort of rove around. Their original idea was like the bishop would be in this RV, this recreational vehicle driving up and down the diocese. I said, if you didn't take one look at me and know I was not going to be that kind of bishop, you were, you know, disillusioned. But anyway, their first two bishops, it didn't go very well. They both came in with a pretty traditional model of episcopate, pretty much my way or the highway. And it didn't go well with the way, the DNA, if you will, of the diocese. And every diocese has a DNA. There's probably no two alike. They're like people. So knowing the system in our diocese was really important. And what we discovered was that honoring the gift of power in all people is really key. And while we've done that really well within the church, now it's time to do that with those outside the church. Because to suppose that because someone's not in the church, they have no power, I think is more disillusionment. They do have power. People have the power to say yes or no, to develop a faith life, all of those things. So it's part of our culture in our diocese to honor the gift of power in all people. As I mentioned earlier, the four orders of ministry, which is certainly all about a conversation, but for us it's a very helpful framing tool to think about boundaries, to think about being collaborative with one another, and to think about being respectful of one another's authority, and also to hold people accountable. So we have a history in our diocese where the really hard stuff that people don't want to do, they give it to the bishop. So because we have an empowered lady that actually understands its order of ministry, I can say, actually, that's yours. It's not mine. So I'll help you figure out how to do it. But in fact, this is your order of ministry. And that's been really, really good for us. I've also learned as a bishop, and just as a human being, I think, in that ability to act, power is shared differently in different contexts. So what might happen in one diocese or congregation isn't necessarily going to work out the same way in another. We have Latino congregations. I'm fully bilingual. But I don't express my power quite the same way I do in one of my Latino congregations as I might in one of my Anglo, highly educated congregations. It would just be a different setting. And it's about learning how to speak the language of power and work with the context. Again, I don't, because it's not my first context, think I have no power to act. I think, how am I going to act? How will I use my power to act? We always have a choice about power between agency and victimhood. We always have a choice. We don't ever, ever have to be a victim based on what somebody else thinks of us or based on what a whole structure or system says about us. We always have agency, always have the ability to act. And I want to advocate for honest sharing of views on scripture, theology, and ethics. We have a triad partnership with the Diocese of Gloucester and with the Diocese of Western Tanganyika, and kind of came about with the question at Lambeth Conference, you know, how much difference could you get in a room and have a relationship that might work? And we have a relationship that works really well. But we started with a few principles. One was that we weren't out to convert the other to our point of view. And another was that we would always be honest. So I was honest about who I am, how I read the text, and how my theological values work, and what's really happening in my diocese. And each of my partner bishops, at that time Jerome Mapongo, now we have Sadok Makaya in Western Tanganyika and Michael Parham in Gloucester, also abided by those principles. And it makes a really big difference when you're trying to work out a situation in which everybody has some power. Change is sustainable when it's incremental. Sometimes it comes in sweeping transformations, like in the renewal of our minds. But after your mind is renewed, after you are converted, sustaining the change that is required is sometimes really hard work. We have a growth rate in our diocese of 2%. And two things throw me there. One, it's not decline. Our decline stopped. And it's a very sustainable rate of change, a very sustainable rate of change that we can just keep moving right along. So I'm not looking for a big, flashy 10 or 20%. I am really happy with that 2%, because I know when I leave the Diocese of El Camino Real, we can look around at each other and say, this was good, and it's set, and it's solid, and it will do what it needs to do. So remember, we have a great big story of salvation here. I was mentoring a group of women clergy under 35 a few months ago, just decided to have a retreat for them, and it was so much fun to be in a room with 20 women under the age of 35 who were all happened to be all priests. And I kept saying to them the whole weekend, or the whole few days, you can have it all, just not all at once, because you can remember back in your 30s, you know, you were making decisions about marriage and babies and, you know, all of that stuff, and it just seemed like it all had to get done in about 2 days, you know, but it doesn't. I'd like to talk about two different kinds of power or authority. We had a really good conversation up here about authority versus leadership. And, you know, leadership is very pop. There's a million books out on it, you know, do this and this will happen. But in the church, we talk about authority, and certainly the authority of ordained ministry is that you, the church, and God all agree that there's something there happening. And our exercise authority is not just in the action, but also in what's going on inside of us. And so there is an inherent spiritual authority and a sense of wisdom of when to act and when not to act. So unilateral authority involves power over, a zero-sum game, a server and a served. It's the most common way that we think about the use of authority and the use of power. It is a paradigm. It's not the only one, but it is a paradigm. We often think about it in the church, and we often apply it to bishops. The problem is, and anybody who's an academic in the area will tell you that as the world, as cultures become more complex, the idea that a zero-sum game is going to work is just falling away. Life is far too complicated to say, if you do this, then this will happen, and it will always stay that way. It is far too complicated to say, I'm going to have power over you and treat you as that I have more power than you and you have less, and that's going to work out. Doesn't work that way anymore. It's interesting because in Christianity, we often move on the model of a server and one to be served. So in order for your ministry to exist, in order for my ministry to exist, I need someone who needs me. Right? But you can hear a lot of stuff in the room about days off being completely tapped out. And that's not necessarily working too well. And I'm not saying that we should lose this paradigm, but I am saying that Jesus actually offers a model in the Gospels of mutual servanthood. And that changes the power over thing. Because if I have to serve you, if you need to be served, I've got some power over you. But if we talk about mutuality and servanthood, that changes the conversation. And it honors that the person that may need something from you also has something to offer you. And that changes how it works. It actually stops the objectification of people. The option is relational authority. And I don't want to label one of these bad or one of these good. The reality is that as a bishop, sometimes I am unilateral in my use of authority. And I say, I'm the bishop, this is the way this thing's going to go. And then I try to be as relational as I can within the unilateral option that I have offered. So I'm not labeling one as good or bad. In fact, it's probably not good to use one or the other exclusively. But in fact, to just develop that repertoire, that stewardship of your own authority, and what's the best way to use it right here in this given moment? Negotiation is at the heart of relational power. One of the tricky things, I think, in this debate around bishops who are women is that it's very hard to negotiate with people that think you either don't exist or that don't want you to exist. And that makes negotiation pretty tricky. But anytime you can find your way into a position where you can say, I want to give you something, I'd like you to give me something, of mutual servanthood, of negotiation, that's your in to transformation. We do have to be willing to be transformed, to have our minds renewed. We do have to be willing participants. God does not force that upon us. But relational authority works by way of saying, let's just find a little opening. In our triad partnership, that's what we did. We just found an opening. And we took it day by day the first 4 months. People say, there's something extraordinarily close about you all in your partnership. And I say, well, that's because we argued for the first 4 months. and in part, it's true, because we told the truth to each other, and we had to find our space of negotiation. What were each of us willing to give in order to create some safe space that we could inhabit together so that something could grow and develop? Relational authority requires us to keep the greater good in mind, again, recognizing that incremental change is what is sustainable. So if you're going for that, you got to keep that, what am I doing this for? Why does this actually matter? Honoring or respecting that all people have power. So even if people you perceive as having no power, they have some power. The use of relational power is messy, requires a high tolerance for difference, and the ability to live with decentering, which means that you are not always going to be in the position of having more power. But in the big scheme of things, you're going to get to where you're going. So that sub-zero game, suddenly you just have to let go of it and recognize you're going to be moving here and there. Does that make sense? Okay. The thing I love about relational power and the things is that everyone potentially gets to participate in the decision-making and living out of the ministry. You get a lot more creativity when you're in relationship with people. You discover things about people you had no idea about, and there's always something fruitful that comes of it. Most importantly, because it's our mission as a church, the reconciling presence of Christ is made known, and we develop a greater trust in that power and authority, which, as Christians, we believe is relational. We are a relational faith. Grace then governs the common life, and relationships are empowered. I want to let you have a little laugh at that for a minute. I've been pondering all this because I, coming from a context where we don't have this debate going on. I spend 5 minutes a year on the subject of being a woman bishop, and actually most of the five occurs when I'm here. It's a non-issue in my context. We're a long way down the road. Time does heal things. But as I've been experiencing this, you know, I can argue this thing and say, this is the right position. I mean, you obviously know what I think. But it doesn't matter. I think it was Hafiz or Rumi, one of the Sufi poets, who said, beyond the field of right doing and beyond the field of wrongdoing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. And I think you need to find your way to that space. And as we were worshiping today, I thought, you know, the most heartbreaking thing about watching this debate go on, it causes a lot of pain. We can see it. You know, I can see it from outside of your context, how very painful it is. But as I ponder the strategizing about legislation, the most difficult thing about it is that you are going to prevent reconciliation from happening. And that's what I'm struggling with. As I watch this thing happen, I think, wow, they're going to delay reconciliation between these two sides yet even longer. And my experience as a bishop, which is a unique experience to bishops, is that we got to work with the canons. Because when the bishop gets called in, I say, you're at the point of the canons. And that means you are at the lowest common denominator of relational functioning. The relationship has completely broken down when you have to go to the canons and say, here's what the law says you should do. And so when you enforce that, when you say, actually, we're going to create canons that prevent reconciliation from happening, I'd ask you to think about that. Think about that. I'm just going to pause for a moment and talk about language, and then I'm going to tell you a really great story about reconciliation. There is no such word as woman bishop. It doesn't exist. I had somebody Googled it for me the other day in a meeting, and actually refers to the breakaway movement of women's ordained ministry in the Roman Catholic Church. They use it. It's not a word. I have two Bishop Barbies in my collection. I think they're the only two on the planet. They are here before you. They're first time being shown in England. And I was not offended when I received these. I thought they were absolutely hilarious. They come about because the daughter of my cathedral dean, on the day we were having our very first time having our partner diocese visit. So we have three bishops in our cathedral. There's, you know, people from this country and from Tanzania. And it's a big celebration. And Alexandria at the time is six. And we have a little love affair going between the two of us. So when I'm there, she's chasing after me all the time and we hang out. So I'm getting these bishops, you know, settled and taking off their vestments in my office. And she's just chattering nonstop. Do you know six-year-olds like that? They don't shut up, right? They did da-da-da-da-da, and she's going on. And I get my vestments off. I said, you know, Alexander, I have to go to the restroom now, which is what we say. I have to go to the loo. Oh, great. I'll come with you. So, okay. Come on. So we go to the loo. And she's chattering away. And we're exiting the loo. And she stops suddenly, and she says, you know, Bishop Marion, there is no Bishop Barbie. And I said, well, Alexandria, you're right. And she said, well, we need to work on that. So I found her mother, who is a nuclear physicist. I said, oh, this is the funniest story. She was mortified. But as I told the clergy the story a few days later, they all decided I needed a Bishop Barbie, so they had one made for me, which is... she on her right, somebody else maybe the one on the left. But I say that because someone this morning, Lucy, was talking about culture and the cultural influences of how women are viewed is very powerful. It doesn't disempower us completely, but it's powerful. And this is not just, you know, a theological debate, a scriptural debate. There's a whole lot of stuff here, including herself, Barbie. And she is still shaping, along with the rest of the culture, the minds and the hearts of 6-year-old children of nuclear physicists, and see whose bishop is a woman. That's just reality. We have to negotiate with that. Again, be careful about saying relational power is what women do. I know lots of men who are brilliant at relational power. It is what you were asking about, is how does it change the culture of the House of Bishops? Our House of Bishops is different because there are women in it. We do negotiation a lot better. A lot less kind of unilateral posturing goes on in our house because there are women there. And I say that because women, to culturally survive, you have to negotiate. I mean, I can't just walk out on the street here at 10 o'clock at night and not have to negotiate my reality as a female walking alone at night. I have to deal with that. And so our place in the culture requires us to just subconsciously negotiate our place all the time. It makes it really hard and really painful in the church when we feel like we have this thing called baptism and the ministry of all the baptized, and yet again we have to negotiate our place. And that's why it's so painful. If you don't understand why it's so painful, that's why it's so painful. We have to do it all the time, everywhere, and we would long to be in a church where we didn't have to do that. So I have one congregation that had an issue with my being a female, their new bishop being a woman. This is Little St. John's Monterey, which is an aging congregation. That's Bob Ott. He's their new rector. You can't see it terribly well. They're a 1928 prayer book congregation, which is traditional in its orientation, you know, facing the wall, old liturgy and so on. I mean, I was, a kid when just learning to read when we let go of the 1928 prayer book in my church. So it's really not part of my language or culture, church culture at all. But it's very strongly part of theirs. Their priest, when I arrived, had been under investigation for something that was settled, but literally as soon as it was settled, somebody pulled up another complaint. So I've been a bishop maybe 2 weeks, and I called the rector. I said, we have to talk. And this is one of those unilateral times. Discipline, that's my territory. So he arrives in my office with 12 members of his vestry. And I said, well, this is interesting. And they're just determined that I'm going to close the church. And I said, I'm not going to close the church. Let's just take a big, deep breath and calm down for a minute and talk this thing through. Unfortunately, I had to discipline the priest, and it was a time of unilateral authority where I said, either you do this or you don't get to be a priest anymore. And he chose not to be any priest anymore, and he left the Episcopal Church. And on the one hand, that was a shame. On the other hand, it actually got him to a place he needed to be and got him the healing that he personally needed. Meanwhile, it gave me the opportunity to say to the congregation, let's negotiate how we're going to have a common life. The only not negotiable thing is that we don't have a relationship. We cannot do that, not only according to the canons, but because we're Christians. And we're going to have to learn to live with each other. So let's take it really slow and figure it out. So I counted all our parish meetings, I counted the vestry meetings as visitation time. I said, let's just be a little bit more liberal with the canons and not worry about worship at the moment. And that took about 3 years, and I celebrated my first Eucharist there last fall. And then next year we plan to do confirmation. And we have a fabulous relationship. And one of the great things is that this 1928 aging congregation, which is actually growing in its own right, is partnering with the latest fresh expressions or emerging church thing that we're doing in the diocese. Now, would you ever put a 1928 prayer book congregation with fresh expressions. But what's happening is this young woman, Robin Denny, who some of you know, she was a missionary in Sudan, has just returned from Sudan, and we had this congregation that's just sitting out there in this town called Gonzales, which used to be mostly Anglo. Anglos have all died off. Latinos have moved in. The Anglos didn't know what to do with them 20 years ago. Church died. So we're going to reinvigorate it and replant it. But St. John's has a real heart for Gonzales because one of their former rectors built that church. So they came to me and said, we've had a vestry meeting and we've decided we're going to tithe some of our rector's time to help this ministry, and we want to help it grow. So I said, great, Gonzales, Trinity Gonzales, can be the preaching station for St. John's Monterey. And they are so excited. Now, if we'd stuck to the canons, if we'd kept our relationship as minimal as it could be, we would never have gotten to this level of creativity. See, I can't think this stuff up. I need a Holy Spirit. This was way beyond my imagination. And it's a great story. And I just can't wait to see what happens. There's a work day a week from Saturday, and they're taking out all the pews. I can't imagine a 1928 congregation taking out pews, but I'm going to go watch on Saturday morning and help take those pews out, and we'll just see what God's going to do with that. So I encourage you not to limit yourself, but to actually create space for relationships where God will do infinitely more than you could ask or imagine through this kind of stewardship of authority. I just thought I'd show a few pictures of just normal life. My bishop's life looks like anybody else's bishop's life. I confirm, I baptize, I have relationships with bishops in the Anglican Communion. Life is good. So with that, it's time to go to questions. I'm slightly over time, I think. But I was meant to leave about 15 minutes for questions, so I'll just open it up. And then somebody call time on the Q&A. That occurs to me, yes. As one who has to work with the canons, that's what occurs to me, is that if you legislate the relationship, what you're saying is, it has to be this way. And instead of just leaving it open and let people figure it out, I know as a woman, I don't know, I know for myself, I'm not going to force myself on a congregation. That's abusive. I'm going to find a way to work with that. And I want to trust. I mean, I trusted St. John's Monterey, and they trusted me, and we worked it out. I've had other situations where I've had to be low with the priest. I mean, I had to be. It was doing damage in the congregation. It's like, I'm sorry, you got to go. We had a departing bulk of a congregation leave for the Anglican Church in North America. The rector and I worked really well together for the departure. We had a service of ending of ministry. We handed back keys. It was a very beautiful thing. No press, no Bob Duncan heralding the moment, none of that. The parishioners in the two congregations still have covenant groups together. And if our ministry is not reconciliation, what is it? So they're divided on human sexuality, but they're finding a way to pray and do Bible study together. I'm not going to prevent that. I'm going to support that. You know, not to get my people back. They're not my, they're God's people. Yeah. So I am suggesting that. I'm not in this church. I don't live here. This is your local context. I'm just suggesting that while legislation might feel like the way to calm it down, what you might end up doing is preventing the healing from happening. And I don't know that. I'm just asking you to consider it. It's a possibility.
I think I just want to reaffirm that and say that the number of times people have said, when I came, I was against the ordination of women, but seeing you there, you have changed my mind. Mm-hmm. If we legislate, then all we're going to do is to put each other in boxes, so never the twain shall meet. Yeah. And people won't ever get a chance of having their minds changed. Not that we set out to, as you said, we don't set out to, we just get on with the business of ministry. Mm-hmm. But I believe entirely that to legislate, to put something in concrete, is actually going to take us in 60-70 years, we're still going to be there.
It objectifies the other and assumes that you know everything there is to know about them. And we do not know everything there is to know about one another. I had a bishop at Lambeth of this church. On our first day, we were doing introductions of one-on-one, and he came and sat next to me and began to speak. He said, "I chose you because I know you won't agree with me." And I said, "Well, okay." I said, "Why don't we just sort of start again? I'm Mary." And we did. We had a great conversation, and actually all through Lambeth, we had really great conversations. We are miles apart on our views and our theology. But the assumption was, he assumed I knew everything I needed to know about him, and that he knew everything there was to know about me. And when we objectify people like that, we are way out of God's will. It is not how God connects with humanity as we understand it in the incarnation in Jesus Christ, which is relational and personal and taking people where they are. And it's a lot of work. You know, actually, I think it's less work. Once you do the relationship thing, you can tell people, look, just calm down. Let's just work it out. And the more trust you build, the more confident you are that you'll work it out. I think now in our partnership, there's probably nothing we won't work out because we've been over some pretty tough hurdles. And, you know, we've got big differences in theology and the way we read scripture and think about women and kids and all that and sexuality and all that stuff. But, you know, the relationship is so important to all of us that it would just, I'd be hard pressed to let it go. And I've made some difficult decisions around it that have cost me. But at the same time, I was like, oh, this is, I have to honor what God's put together here, you know. So, time? Okay. Thank you all very much for your attention.